continue. And let's see what this is saying.
Got it.
Go live. Isn't it going live? You do not have permission to live stream. What do you mean I don't have permission to live stream? How do I get permission to live stream?
It's bad when you're contradicted by a machine.
This used to work all the time. All right, let's try this. All right, here she is. All right, let me.
Yay.
There, yeah.
All right, give her a second to log in. Hello, Dr. Sambruna.
You're muted.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm here. Hi. I'm sorry. I was waiting on another link.
Okay. So I just wanted to double check with you. Is it okay if we record the meeting?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And I think we're going to be trying to broadcast it to a Facebook page and go live, and I'll copy it over later.
Shush.
And I don't have permission to do it to my own one. Oh, well, it's not going to get done to Facebook then. Okay. So we are recording. Go ahead, Guy, and do your stuff.
Okay. Well, welcome everybody to the October meeting of the National Capital Astronomers. My name's Guy Brandenburg. I'm the president this year, and people have given me their sympathies for having taken that job on. It hasn't been too bad so far. A couple of things that are coming up. The Exploring the Sky, and Jay Miller's going to tell us a little bit about that. That got rained out on the 1st of October because hurricane.
Because you got to share.
But
audio.
We,
yeah.
In at the beginning of November, I think it's November 5th, and we can always use people to help. And let's see, telescope making is continuing. We have somebody working on a 17 and a half and a 6-inch and a 10-inch, as well as also making electronic drives for telescope. We have, if you haven't already joined our listserv, I strongly recommend that you do that. You can send an email to me directly at gfbrandenburg@yahoo.com, and I can add you to the list. Let's see. We need a membership committee or person or two to help sort out new members and direct them to whatever activity that they want to go. I don't think a lot of time, but it will take some time. So please think about volunteering. Or if you have a friend that you want to volunteer that you think they would be a good thing, that would be very helpful. Tomorrow is the NOVAC, Northern Virginia Astronomy Club meeting. And that's both virtual and in person. I'm speaking to you from Hopewell Observatory, which is out I-66, about 30, 40 miles west of the Beltway. And we are having an open house on the 15th of this month. It's rained out and or clouded, and we'll be there on the 22nd. I think that's all I have. Jay, did you want to say something about Exploring the Sky and the newsletter?
And before I do, would you, you're a member of Northern Virginia Astronomy Club?
Yes, I'm a member of both.
Okay. I would like to try to get a hold of Jeff Chester because I have not been able to send Stardust to the Naval Observatory.
I'll do that.
And I don't have his email address, so I can't get in touch with him. So, you know, but have him get in touch with me. All right. So far we've only been able to have one exploring the sky, and that was the September one. And it was just clear enough that we were able to see a few things. As Guy said, October was clouded out. The last one of the year will be 7 o'clock, November 5th. And as always, you know, if you got a telescope, please bring it. Hopefully it will be clear. There was some problems of getting assistance from the Park Service, the Nature Center, but they've been able to help us out. And so that's been taken care of. Next year will begin again in April. Now, I'm supposed to have my hip surgery resurfaced. It's supposed to get the cup replaced sometime early next year. So I won't be able to maybe bring a telescope for the April one. So I will, I'll try to be there, but I will need assistance. So again, with more telescopes, but by then I will let people know about, in emails or through the meeting. So anyway, that's pretty much all I've got to say right now. So anyway, the last meeting will be, the last Exploring the Sky will be the 5th of November, 7 o'clock. And that noise is one of my cats.
Okay. Thank you,
Jim. Make an announcement?
Yes, please.
The APS Senior Physicist Group will have a talk on Wednesday, October 19 at 1 p.m. The talk is Stochastic Computational Electrostatics and Applications, Computing Capacitance. The speaker is Michael Mascagni from Florida State University. There is a link to the announcement in the calendar on page 7 of Stardust. There is a link there to register. You click on that, and then they will send you the link to the Zoom meeting.
Okay, thank you. Jim Simpson, do you have a few words to say?
Yes, I guess so. For better or worse, I am now your treasurer. And I'm also taking care of all the, you know, the membership renewals. When I inherited the job here, the best compilation we had was about 100 people in the club that was on the last list we had. So far this year, we're going through our renewals, and we've got about 50 people who have either renewed or are life members, are new members, or a couple cases of complimentary memberships. So we've got a ways to go for getting everybody renewed. Now, out of that, so far we got 50. Of those, about 11 of them, believe it or not, are new from, at least we weren't on the list from last year. Three of them are Science Fair members, so those are complimentary memberships. But we have 8 people who we've picked up either as new members or came from, several years ago. People had dropped out of the club and for whatever reason. So they're back in there. And I also want to thank Elizabeth Warner very much for setting up the ability for us to do PayPal and fill out the membership things online. So far, the breakout is 15 people have paid by check, 21 have paid by PayPal. So that seems to be working pretty well. The treasury balance, so we're doing pretty well. We have paid off a couple things. One was getting our liability insurance reinstated that had lapsed a couple years ago. So we now have that back online. So if somebody breaks their leg at one of the Stardust at the outreach meetings, least they can't sue us, or at least we'll have liability to cover it. And the other one was we've got two Sky and Telescope subscriptions, paid for those for Science Fair winners. That was their prize for doing that. So things seem to be going okay. If anybody has any questions, feel free to contact me.
Yeah. Jim, did you get my membership check?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Did you get my membership check? It hasn't cleared my bank account.
I'm sorry, who's talking?
I'm Jack Gaffey.
Oh, I don't recall it. I'd have to actually look to see who's
I mailed it September 3.
Oh.
All right. You all can look that up later.
Yeah. Send me, if anybody's questioning whether or not they're on there, send me an email. Okay. I'm in the Stardust. Just send me an email and I'll check.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Any other announcements?
I have one question. When do we want to cut people off who haven't paid their dues for getting Stardust and membership?
I think next issue.
Next issue will be the November issue. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. All right. Hearing no other announcements, John, do you want to introduce?
Yes. Yeah. It's a great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, Dr. Rita Sambruna. Dr. Sambruna is an astrophysicist at the Goddard Space Flight Center, where she's the deputy director of the astrophysics science section, which is very important to the field. She obtained a degree in physics with high honors at the University of Milan in Italy. She then earned master's and PhD degrees in physics from the International School for Advanced Studies for her research on the X-rays emitted by the relativistic jets produced by the supermassive black holes that are the centers of all galactic bulges. The jets occur during the time intervals when the black holes are ingesting material from their environments. Dr. Sambruna has done a staggering amount of work on that topic. She uses data from an unusually wide variety of instruments, the Hubble Space Telescope, the Fermi Gamma Ray Telescope, SWIFT, Suzaku, XMM Newton, Chandra, and so on. The list is really quite substantial and is well beyond those I've named. Dr. Sambruna was a postdoctoral fellow at the Space Telescope Institute near Baltimore, and then did research at the Goddard Space Flight Center and at Penn State University. She then became a professor of physics and astronomy at George Mason University, and then returned to Goddard as a senior scientist for the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. After that, at NASA headquarters, she led multiple major programs. She was involved in the plans for what used to be called WFIRST, the Wide Field Infrared Space Telescope, which has since been renamed the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope after our very long-term member, Nancy Grace Roman. Notably, Dr. Sambruna was NASA's program scientist for LISA, the Orbiting European Gravitational Wave Observatory, which is still to be launched, and which will detect G waves at low frequencies that the ground-based G wave observatories LIGO and Virgo cannot detect. Although the sources of high frequency G waves are rare and emit only briefly, the sources of low frequency G waves are abundant and emit over long time intervals. So being able to detect them will really revolutionize astronomy. Dr. Sambruna is a leading figure in the current great expansion of activity in what is called multi-messenger astronomy, which is astronomy that combines information brought to us by electromagnetic radiation, meaning light, X-rays, et cetera, with information brought to us by other types of radiation, especially G waves. Her contributions have been recognized by prestigious awards. Namely, she's been elected a fellow of the American Astronomical Society and has received NASA's Exceptional Achievement Award. Dr. Sambruna.
Many thanks, John. This is a very flattering introduction. So let me see if I can, let me try to share my screen here. Hopefully I don't use Zoom much. Let's try again. So share. Share desktop one. Let me try. Yeah, so it's not collaborating. Hang on a second, my husband is helping me here.
Alternatively, if you want to email me your...
It's a big file. No, it's a big file because it has a lot of... So I need to quit and reopen. So I will be back.
Okay.
She is listed as co-host, so she should be able to chair.
I think she was just having some other kinds of issues. A lot of the Goddard people actually don't use Zoom. They use another platform, and so they're very unfamiliar with it. And I think some of their computers are actually blocked from using Zoom.
Uh-oh.
But she, I would have
I think you're right. And their platform doesn't work half the time either. Oh, there it is.
There we go.
All right, thank you, Joe. So this is the wrong slide. Hang on for a moment. I'm gonna have to go back to the top. Okay, there we go. So sharing in full mode. Okay, so I'm very pleased to be here with all of you tonight to be talking about multi-messenger and time domain astrophysics and what we are doing at NASA, what capabilities we are using and what else we are doing to facilitate this very exciting science. So this is a brief outline of my talk. First of all, let's talk about what is multi-messenger and time domain astrophysics. And John has already given you the scoop, right? It's using electromagnetic light as well as non-electromagnetic light, primarily gravitational waves and particles, to explore the universe. And I will focus on two particular objects. So I want to thank my colleague, Dr. Regina Caputo at Goddard, for sharing some slides of the science part. And I am now an administrator and I don't get to do much research. So Regina kindly shared some of her slides with me. And then we will talk about how we make that happen. NASA missions currently operating and those in development, specifically for multi-messenger and time domain. And finally, what's needed for the future. And I give you a preview, coordination, communication, and collaboration. Okay, so let's start with the decadal, the astrophysics decadal survey. So as you may know, this is the most influential community-driven review of the field that happens every 10 years by law. And the decadal provides recommendations to all the three agencies that fund astrophysics, NASA, NSF, and DOE. So the 2020 Astrophysics Decadal highlighted three main topics, and one of them is new messenger and new physics. So they call it a dual revolution. The Decadal speaks about dual revolution brought together by multi-messenger astrophysics and time domain. So this makes it a very hot topic and a very high topic and a topic of very high interest, because NASA and all the agencies take their marching orders from the decadals, so expect investments in the future, and we will see what the decadal has recommended in particular. So let me start with this video. And can you hear the sound if I start the video?
No.
So this is the problem. How can I share my sound with you?
Nick, turn up your, do you have your audio on your computer turned up, or, because it should be
playing, yeah,
whatever is, yeah, on the computer.
Okay, I'm gonna make it max. Let me see if you can hear now. No. Anything?
No. Check what the sound level is on the little sound button off to the right on the player. So you see the little button towards the right, and it's turned up. Yeah, we don't hear anything.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Okay.
I think there's something on the share screen menu to share your audio.
It's not important. We can just skip this. If we don't find it.
You're using headphones, or, yeah, sometimes it gets blocked because it's going through your headphones rather than, so you might want to try to see if you can play it without having your headphones plugged in.
Yeah, let me try that. And if it doesn't work, we will continue, because I can tell you in words what this is about. Okay, so this shows a picture of a beautiful forest. And so imagine to be in this forest and just being able to see without hearing any sound. You form a certain picture of what's going on in this forest, right? So now imagine to turn on the sound, and you can hear the birds singing.
Now we have,
yeah.
You can hear the birds singing, and if you wait, a few other animals are going to chime in. Or maybe a lion, or maybe a tiger. And so the point here is that the multi-messenger is about what you don't see in the forest. The forest is what we see, so it's our regular multi-wavelength universe in our visible light. But if we add what we cannot see, but we can hear, like gravitational waves or particles, our picture of the forest changes substantially. So this metaphor to bring about the concept that multi-messenger adds a new dimension in our understanding of the universe. And so here is the picture of the galaxy. So let's start with something that everybody can relate to. The Milky Way in different colors. So going from the top to the bottom, we are moving from radio wavelengths to neutral hydrogen, molecular hydrogen, infrared, optical, ultraviolet, infrared, optical, ultraviolet, and gamma rays. And you can see how the light, the picture of the galaxy changes depending on the wavelengths. At each wavelength, we get a different perspective, a different physical mechanism at work. So if we want to understand the various components of the Milky Way or any other galaxy, we really need to be looking at different wavelengths. So we have thermal processes in the infrared and optical with the stars shining, the galaxies. We have known thermal processes at high energies, generally high energy particles moving in strong magnetic fields, emitting synchrotron inverse Compton radiation. And so this is the electromagnetic spectrum that summarizes what I just said. And the only point that I want to make here is to draw your attention to the top part of the spectrum, to the bands that do not penetrate the Earth atmosphere. So we can look at the sky in radio from Earth, in the infrared, in the visible, but from the ultraviolet to gamma rays, we only rely on space. So this is to make the point that NASA has a big part in multi-messenger astrophysics, because only with NASA missions we can access the higher energies of the spectrum, which is where the most energetic particles and the highest magnetic field reveal themselves. And so here is the, how do we do that? Well, I want to talk about the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which is one of the workhorses for multi-messenger astrophysics at NASA. Fermi operates from several hundred MeV to GeV energies, and opened for us the gamma ray sky. Here you see the launch of Fermi in 2008 via a Delta rocket at Cape Canaveral. And here you see the two main instruments that most relevant for our analysis. So the Large Area Telescope, which covers 20% of the sky at once and rotates, covering the whole sky every 3 hours. And the Gamma Ray Burst Monitor right here, which is a full, which covers the sky continuously. So this is a main a point to keep in mind. The Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope is unique for our study of the multi-messenger or multi-wavelength universe because of this continuous coverage. And to make that point, I am going to show you in the next slide, the gamma ray, the Fermi sky. So this is a dynamic view of the gamma ray sources detected by Fermi in over 2.5 years of observations. Fermi operates only in survey mode, so it's always observing the sky, and every 3 years it completes a full circle. So what you see here is many gamma ray sources, which are stationary, but others that keep popping up here and there in the sky with various brightness. And this last one on August 17, 2017, is the famous GW170817, which is the merger of two neutron stars that generated a gamma ray event, but also gravitational waves. And we will talk about this a little bit in a few minutes. So here you see the event with the pictorially depicted the gamma ray, the gravitational waves propagating from the site of the merger. There we go. So what are these objects? Let me tell you the story from the beginning. Let's talk about the gamma ray burst, because GW170817 is a piece of the puzzle that explains gamma ray burst. So gamma ray bursts are the brightest gamma ray sources in the sky. They emit prodigious amount of gamma rays in a very short time. in the end time is different for long and short gamma ray burst. So the long gamma ray burst vary on time scale from seconds to days, several hours and days. And they are related to the core collapse of supernovae. So their progenitors is a massive star that has collapsed and has produced a high velocity jet, relativistic jet of material. It emits in gamma rays and then it fades down into X-rays. And then we have the short gamma ray bursts that are the shortest. They last on milliseconds to few seconds. And their origin has been a mystery until recently, until the detection of the neutron star merger that I mentioned before, GW170817. So here is the detection of this remarkable object in LIGO. The LIGO source is called the GW170817 because it was detected 17 August 2017. The Fermi object is a short gamma ray burst, which is named GRB 170817A. So LIGO from Livingston and Hartford is a ground-based detector. There are two instruments, one in Haverford in Washington State and one in Livingston, which is near Baton Rouge in Louisiana. And both of them detected gravitational waves, a significant emission of gravitational waves from two coalescing neutron stars. 3 seconds later, Fermi detected a pulse of gamma ray light. So again, look at your screen for the detection of the gamma ray light, the gamma ray waves on the bottom panel, and the 3 seconds later of the gamma ray flare with Fermi. So converting the gravitational waves in sound, you see the minute of you see that the time here of the coalescence, the so-called chirp, when the two neutron stars merge, emit the most gravitational waves and the most energy through gravitational waves. And then 3 seconds later, right, 2 seconds later, there is a blip in Fermi. So I'm going to send it again now that you know. Merger and gamma ray emission. Okay, so in more scientific terms, this is the collection of data from that object. So GW170817 was a watershed moment for multi-messenger astrophysics because for the very first time, we had a combination of electromagnetic light from radio to gamma rays with the gravitational waves, a known electromagnetic messenger. And so you see here in the top, again, the LIGO process, right? The spiraling in of the two, this is a pictorial representation of the gravitational waves of the strain, right? The frequency versus the time. So here it shows the spiraling of the two neutron stars closer and closer and closer until they merge and chirp. This is the Fermi flare and also detected by Integral, a European gamma ray observatory. And this is the spectrum at various energies from the infrared to the blue. And you can see that most of the energy here in the afterglow is emitted at infrared, right? Infrared energies. So this is the collection of the data from the discovery paper. And so starting with gamma rays versus time. So this is the differential, T time minus the time of the chirp. So the gravitational waves mark the detection. The gamma rays happens 3 seconds later, 2 seconds later, and then continues with variations. In this panel. Then we have X-ray emission that starts a little bit later, UV, optical, infrared, radio. So what I want to drive your attention to, because we will come back to this point towards the end of my talk, is the enormous amount of observatories involved in this campaign, in these observations. So literally hundreds and hundreds of scientists jumped on their telescopes, on their observatories, and pointed to this object after the alert came out from Fermi and LIGO to catch the afterglow of the gamma ray burst. And so you can see here, especially in the optical, so many observers, also including amateur astronomers. This thing was so bright in the sky at 18 or 19 magnitudes that could even be visible from your from an amateur astronomer telescope. So we were lucky here. It was one object that attracted a lot of attention. It was detected on time. The alert was sent out soon enough that everybody could jump on their observing machines. But we are not going to be that lucky in the future if events like this become routine. So GW started the so-called multi-messenger age. And here is in a pictorial, in a video, what I just told you in words, right? The process, the two neutron stars. This is an artist rendition, spiraling around each other, losing energy, and then coalescing. The chirp emits gamma ray, emits gravitational waves, and shoots a jet. Is a material from the disrupted neutron stars that is being accelerated and emits in infrared, optical, and ultraviolet. So let me show it this again with the various components again, one more time. Spiraling of the two neutron stars. As they get closer, they lose energy. Gravitational waves are emitted at the moment of the coalescence. The jet is launched with a gamma ray and X-ray emission. And then this cloud is the unbound material, the so-called kilonova, that emits in infrared, optical, and ultraviolet. And then there is shocked material all around in the interstellar medium that emits radio wavelengths. Okay, so what did we learn from all this? One of the most important things that we learned from this observation is the origin of the heavy elements in the periodic table of the elements. And in particular, elements like gold and platinum, we now know that are produced in the merging of neutron stars. So by the so-called R process, rapid neutron capture. So when the neutron stars merge, the unbound material that disrupted from the neutron stars is ejected at very high speeds. And this favors nucleosynthesis. So heavy nuclei capture neutrons, forming unstable isotopes of the material, the isotope decays, this radiation warms up the gas and emits in infrared through ultraviolet. But also heavy elements are formed, just like you see here, platinum and gold. So now if we look at the table, we have an explanation for the origin of all the elements in the table, right? So helium, hydrogen comes from cosmology, right? Big Bang, part of helium is also cosmological. Other comes from the inside of neutron stars. The heavier material comes from massive stars or exploding white dwarfs. And now we have completed the table pointing out the origin in yellow of all the heavy elements from the kilonova, like the one in GW 170817. We also learned a few other things. We learned that the speed of gravity is equal to the speed of light, confirming general relativity. And this constrains some models for dark matter. We also learned that gravitational waves also allow you to estimate the distance of the source independently. And so if you have that estimate of the distance from the gravitational waves and the redshift from optical photometric observations or spectrometry, you can derive the Hubble constant. And you know very well that this is one of the fundamental measurements in astrophysics. So lots more to come in the future. Of course, we need to detect more kilonovae like GW 170817. So far, we only had one. Okay, let me stop. Let me stop here for a second and see if there is any question on this part.
Raise your hand or unmute yourself and ask. Anyone? Okay, I think we're all good.
Okay. All right, let's keep going then. So here I am on the wrong slide. Bear with me for a moment. Let me go back up. One more. Okay. So we talked about Fermi and how the large coverage of the sky and continued coverage of the skies allows gamma ray burst variable sources to be detected. So we talked about gamma ray burst, and we saw that a particular kind of gamma ray burst are the short ones, which if oriented favorably towards us, we can see the jet, we can see the kilonova, and more importantly, we detect them as in gravitational waves. But gamma ray bursts are not the only variable sources detected by Fermi. Here you have the 3 months of observations of Fermi. And you're going to see a movie now of the variations of these sources over time. These sources are called blazars and are extragalactic sources, active galactic nuclei. So as you can see here, they pop up unexpectedly from everywhere in the sky, and their intensity varies, even on a factor of 10. So these objects are active galactic nuclei dominated by a jet that points close to our line of sight. And Fermi has detected, has observed over 2,000 blazars. So the issue here is to understand the origin of this large variability occurring in the jet. And a more fundamental problem is to understand how the jets are formed near the black hole and how and their composition. So let me tell you that there are two dominating models for the origin of jets, for the composition of jets. There are leptonic models which affirm that jets are dominated by electron and positrons, so leptonic particles moving at near the speed of light down the jet. And there are hadronic processes which posit that the jet is made of electrons and protons. So now you understand that the difference is remarkable, because to accelerate protons to the speed of light requires very different mechanism than to accelerate just electrons and positrons. So it's an important question, the composition of the jets in blazars. And one of the smoking guns for hadronic models are neutrinos. So the search for neutrino was up. IceCube is our primary detector. It's a kilometer wide detector which is underground. And so far it had not detected any neutrinos of extragalactic objects. So here you see again on the background here, the Fermi sky with the blazars, right, in a static depiction. And there are a couple of hot spots emitting neutrinos here, but nothing is significant. There is no significant source in over 10 years of integration for IceCube data, none that overlaps with any of the Fermi sky. So it turns out that this is not the right way to search for neutrinos, because we now know that these events, the neutrino emission, is weak because IceCube doesn't have that much of the sensitivity. We are able to detect only one, two neutrino at most. So if you integrate the data over 10 years, any weak emission gets washed out. So this is not the right way to do it. I'm going to show you another way. So this is again the gamma ray sky, right, with the blazars popping up and down. And these are the neutrino alerts emitted when there is, so an alert is sent out when there is a significant detection of neutrinos. And so if I run the movie in terms of time, so the vertical red is the alert, the time of the emission of the alert, and compared to the Fermi sky, you're going to see that there is no coincidence, there is no detection of neutrinos reported until 2017. So wait for it. In 2017, we start some associations of neutrino emission and gamma ray sources. And so here you go. There is this source right here, which is the most significant association. The blue dot is our best estimate of where the neutrino source is. And the background is the Fermi source again. So there is pretty good coincidence. So this is the detection, the first detection of an extragalactic neutrinos from an AGN, from a blazar. So here we go, the smoking gun of hadronic models. If we believe this association between the neutrino and the blazar in gamma rays, we have evidence for hadronic models in there. So I'm going to skip this one and go straight to what we learned. So what did we learn from neutrinos? We learned that blazars have jets which are made of both protons and electrons traveling at near the speed of light. And so since these speeds are so high, the mechanism for accelerations of both the electrons, but especially of the protons, need to be something really fantastic, really powerful. And we still don't know what causes these enormous accelerations of heavy particles in the jet. So what we learned is that a blazar consists of a black hole surrounded by an accretion disk, supermassive black hole surrounded by an accretion disk that emits thermal radiation. And then somehow near the black hole, a jet is produced, right, that moves where protons and electrons move at nearly the speed of light and emit relativistically. Okay, so I'm about to shift now to how we know what we know. And so the role of NASA and the astrophysics missions. So let me pause again to see if there is any questions from anybody. And so if not, we continue. And we are going to talk now about the way we collect this information at the higher energies from space. So we're going to talk about the NASA astrophysics missions that support multi-wavelength, multi-messenger and time domain astronomy. So here is quite old slide, to tell you the truth, that shows the astrophysics fleet. So we start here. The outer spiral is for traditional missions, all the way back to Ariel, right? And these are the main big mission. We see Roman, we see COSI, we see SpheREx. So these are all missions in implementation. And we continue with Webb, XP, the date is the time when they were launched and became operational, and all the way up to Hubble. So these are the bigger medium-sized missions. And then we have very small missions like CubeSat, small sats that also serve a big role in multi-messenger astrophysics. They don't have such a big field of view, but they are good to follow transients. So not all of these missions have a role in multi-messenger and time domain, of course, but the most important ones are just a subset. Because as we saw from the science presentation, in order to catch a time variable source in the sky, a transient, we need a larger field of view. We need a survey mode, a mission that operates in continuous scanning of the sky. So we need larger field of view and continuous coverage of the sky. We need sensitivity and low background, if possible. And we need a rapid response for target of opportunity. So the big, large field of view operating in continuous mode is able to catch the transient, but then there are transients that occur outside the field of view and are seen by other missions. And so you need a rapid response for your observatory to get there and catch the transient. And so there are not that many missions in the NASA fleet that fulfill these requirements. The two most important ones are marked here, SWIFT, Fermi, among the traditional bigger missions, and TESS, which is, believe it or not, is an exoplanet mission that turns out to be very important also for other kind of sources. And so we already talked about the workhorse number one, the Fermi Observatory. I want to talk a little bit about the Neil Gehrels SWIFT observatories. So SWIFT is a robotic observatory that operates in optical, infrared, X-rays, and also at gamma rays with a wide field of view. The particular characteristic of this observatory is that the gamma ray burst was designed for gamma ray burst. They are detected on board in the burst alert telescope. And autonomously, after this detection, the observatory is loose to repoint to the detected gamma ray burst in X-rays and UV optical with a response of no longer than 100 seconds, so a little over a minute. So the point to keep in mind is that this observatory was designed for gamma ray burst, but works really well for all other time domain, time variable sources. It works in different bands, gamma ray, X-rays, and UV optical. And it covers a large portion of the sky almost continuously, and it moves rapidly so that you can go after the variable sources everywhere. So TESS is depicted here. And this is a MIDEX, a medium-sized explorer that was launched in 2019. And it is still operating fantastically. So TESS is the successor to Kepler, which has detected lots and lots of exoplanets. TESS continues the legacy of Kepler and operates in this particular mode. It takes strips of the sky every number of days from the equator to the pole, both in the northern hemisphere and in the southern hemisphere. So depending on where you are in the sky, TESS covers the area from a minimum of a few days to a full year at the poles. So you understand that this continuous coverage and complete coverage of the sky, even though it was designed for exoplanets, works really well also for other kind of variable sources. And in fact, TESS has provided a mine of data to study blizzards, for example, as collateral damage, so to speak. So this, for example, is our friend TXS-0506, the neutrino blazar that we talked about before. And these are two serendipitous light curves obtained from TESS that happened to scan the sky around this source. So my colleague, Krista Smith, has collected a number of these extensive light curves that you can see span a very long time scale. And she's in the process of analyzing these remarkable variations that occur on time scale, on every kind of time scales, from minutes to hours to days to years. So a mine of information here from these fortuitous, I would say, light curves. Now I'm going to shift to new missions that are still in formulation. So one of the recommendations of the decadal report was to NASA to develop, to amplify the line of explorer missions and build more explorers dedicated to multi-messenger and time domain astrophysics. And we listened, and one of these missions is now in formulation at Goddard Space Flight Center. It's a MIDEX, medium-sized explorer, called the STAR-X. STAR-X is an acronym. I forgot what it stands for, but the basic telescope, the basic components of STAR-X are an X-ray telescope, And Enutra, which you see here, this big tube here, this is the focal plane with the detectors down here. And this is the telescope that takes the X-rays and focuses them on the focal plane. And then there is an ultraviolet telescope as well, right here. So, The salient features of STAR-X that make it perfect for multi-messenger astrophysics are, once again, the multi-band simultaneous coverage, the large field of view, which is 1 degree in both X-rays and UV, the fast response to flaring targets. It gets on target from anywhere in less than 2 minutes, 90% of the time. And it, the high observing efficiency spends a lot of time doing real observations of the targets. And it has a long mission life because it has no consumables. So this will make STAR-X another powerhouse for the study for multi-messenger and time domain astrophysics. And these are the science goals of STAR-X, from supernovae to neutron star mergers, our friends here, stellar flares, cosmology, extreme accretion. So there's gonna be a bonanza of data here on your favorite class of objects. Another mission in development with Goddard contribution is COSI. This is a small explorer that has a wide field of view and operates at 100 of MeV energies, so in the soft gamma rays. This is an unexplored band of the electromagnetic spectrum. And one of the goals of COSI is to probe the physics of multi-messenger events, among other things. So COSI is being developed, the PI of COSI is John Tomsek at University of Berkeley, but Goddard, NASA, is providing the anti-coincidence shields on the telescope, and NASA will launch COSI, if everything goes well, in 2026 in low Earth orbit, and we provide daily full sky coverage of the MeV skies. So lots of surprises are expected here from this poorly explored wave band. And how not to conclude with Roman, our next flagship. So to give the forte of Roman Space Telescope, which will be launched in 2027, is its large field of view. And to give you an idea of how large this field is that makes it ideal for time domain astronomy. I'm gonna start here with a little montage. This is a ground base image of Abel 426 with the, and this central galaxy is NGC 1275, which is a famous galaxy because it contains a cooling core. So now the movie is gonna show you the Hubble field of view, right, and the view of 1275. And now zooming out, it's going to show you the Roman view of the same cluster of galaxies. And so you can see how big the Roman field of view is compared to Hubble, and how much sharper the PSF, the resolution, is compared to ground-based image. So the large field of view makes it really ideal for detecting transient sources. Okay, so the next topic, I'm going to shift topic now. So let me see if there is any questions for about these missions that I talked about before I switch to the last part of my talk. Yes.
What about LUVOIR? Are you going to talk about that?
So LUVOIR, that's a good question. So LUVOIR is the next-to-next flagship, right? The one that we are going to do after we launch Roman. There's nothing going on right now because we need to finish Roman. LUVOIR would be a very powerful 6-meter telescope and operating in optical infrared and ultraviolet. And it's primarily designed to discover exoplanets and to study exoplanets. But yes, LUVOIR will have also a role in multi-messenger astrophysics, just like Webb has a role, but their field of view is small. So these missions like LUVOIR and Webb are going to be used to just follow up a detection. So a transient in a gamma rays or in other wavelengths or a gravitational wave detection. We are going to use LUVOIR to point there and study in detail the optical counterpart. Per se, LUVOIR would be too busy to be only doing time domain and multi-messenger because it's being designed primarily for exoplanets and other kind of astrophysics. Good questions. Anybody else? All right, let me move on then. And this is the last part of my talk. So I talked about GW170817 and the discovery of the kilonova. That was, and I said that we were lucky. And we were lucky indeed, not just because that event happened in the near universe and LIGO could detect it. If it had been just twice as distant, LIGO would not have detected the gravitational waves. There wouldn't be not enough sensitivity for LIGO. But we were also lucky that we had only one event and everybody was pointing their telescope to this event. So now imagine the future and imagine advanced LIGO with much, much bigger sensitivity. It is expected that events like the kilonova, GW170817, will occur at least once a week. So how are we going to follow up all these events? You saw that it took a lot of people and a lot of telescope to get all that data. We need moving to the future, if we want to reap the best science out of events like that, we are gonna have to be organized and coordinate, communicate, and collaborate with each other. And so this brings me to MOSAIC, Multi-Messenger Operational Science Support and Astrophysics Collaboration, which I have started at Goddard. And so this is a consortium, a collaboration of two NASA centers, Goddard and Marshall Space Flight Center. And so far, a couple of local universities, Vanderbilt, West Virginia University, George Washington University, and Louisiana State University, which is the home of LIGO, by the way. So MOSAIC is a collaboration that aims at bringing people together, ground space, space-based, physics, astronomy, astrophysics, so that we can all collaborate with each other and reap the best science out of future events like the kilonova in 2017. So Mosaic is based on the 3C, coordinate, plan and execute observations together, communicate often and regularly with each other to tell each other what we are doing, what we are using, so that we don't duplicate resources and we use all existing resources efficiently, and collaborate, share ideas and tools for data analysis and interpretation. So this will be a service to the community to facilitate bringing together ground and space-based observers, but not just observers, also theorists, data scientists, computing scientists from astronomy and physics. So what does this collaboration do? The collaboration provides several services. So provides expertise in observations, data analysis, and interpretations through our scientists at NASA centers and universities and through students, so that we can together have more ideas and more innovation in analyzing the data and interpreting them. It provides a connection from ground and space-based for planning jointly, so development also of tools for observers and proposers from for NASA missions. We are going to help proposers schedule their observations, keeping into account all the windows, the constraints for all the missions in space and on the ground, so to find the best time to observe the sources, the best mission to observe a source in a given time. Mosaic provides also alerts through the GCN, Global Coordinate Network, so that you all know when a source has exploded and produces gamma rays, when a source produces gravitational waves or neutrinos, and you can take your telescope and go there and observe the electromagnetic counterparts. It also provides expertise for designing missions, mission development support. It provides computing resources, archives of the data through the high energy astrophysics archive based at Goddard. It also has a space communication capabilities and expertise to study how to facilitate the communication of data from the mission to the ground, make it faster, more reliable, more efficient, and in a future, in a near future, actually bypass the ground base, the ground station completely, transmitting data from spacecraft to spacecraft, which saves time and optimizes the response of the observatories. And finally, we also have a big component in STEM education and training of students. Multi-messenger and time domain is a very fascinating object field of astrophysics because it involves black holes, merging neutron stars, merging black holes, things that explode, violence. So it really engages students and the public, and it becomes a good opportunity to provide a training in a STEM disciplines. And we also have it in our charter to provide regular workshops and brainstorming sessions and conferences to bring everybody together and talk about the problems of multi-messenger astrophysics and how to resolve them together. Innovation requires many brains, requires people coming from every path of life, requires people coming together and talking and collaborating and sharing ideas and tools to figure out innovative solutions to old problems and to future problems. And so Mosaic is just the avenue to do this. We also want to provide access to the field by non-traditional communities, people coming from underrepresented communities, for example, that do not have big resources like time at Keck, time on big telescopes to do their science. We want to help them access the data and have the tools to analyze the data. And finally, it satisfies the open science requirement. 2023 would be the year of open science at NASA, where we are required, NASA is required to put everything public, from the software to the data to the models. And so this is my last slide. We have already started bringing the community together. We held a workshop in Annapolis last August that saw about 100 people in person and more online, a 3-day workshop that was very successful. Ground-based and space-based people came together for the first time and started talking about common problems, about connecting, about coordinating. We are writing a white paper for NASA that will be public in a month. The next event, if you are interested, the next event in multi-messenger and time domain is going to be a special session at the next American Astronomical Society in Seattle in January. And so everybody is welcome there. If you happen to be in Seattle at that time for that meeting, you are welcome to the special session. And so here are my conclusions. The decadal talked about a dual revolution of time domain and multi-messenger. And I hope I have provided you with a demonstration that indeed it is a revolution of the field. Multi-messenger adds what we cannot see, but that is there and provides a different perspective. NASA has a unique role because only NASA observatories provide access to the shortest wavelengths that do not reach the Earth. And finally, we are looking to the future and to prepare for more events and more multi-messenger science through coordination, communication, and collaboration of the community. And so thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to present what NASA is doing for multi-messenger. And I welcome your more questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you have questions, go ahead and one at a time, unmute yourself, and it'll kind of help if you maybe raise your hand either with a reaction button or like physically so we can call on you. All right, Manjunath, go ahead.
Yes, I have a couple of questions. The Fermi project. So since its launch was the GW-1708 was the only GRV that it recorded, or was there any more?
No. Sorry if I gave you this impression. No. Fermi, the LAT has detected thousands of gamma ray bursts, long and short, and many other gamma ray varying sources and also persistent gamma ray sources. It has detected pulsars as well. That's also another treasure trove from the last 10 years of LAT observations. There is a rich archive there.
Okay. And you showed the very interesting thing was the periodic table you showed, with how these elements, where they may have been formed. So when there are these big GRBs and other explosions, has there been any effort to follow up what happens to that material that is blown out?
Yes, excellent questions. So the afterglow, right?
Yes.
The, after the gamma rays, the jet cools down in X-rays and optical and radio. And so, yes, SWIFT that I mentioned is one of these telescopes that goes after the gamma ray bursts and observes it in X-rays and UV optical. Because SWIFT has on board not just a wide field imager that detects the gamma ray burst, but also an X-ray telescope, a UV telescope, and an optical telescope. And once the gamma ray burst is detected, autonomously repoints, SWIFT repoints itself to catch the afterglow. So absolutely, in order to see what happens to the material, you need to go to the other wavelengths, and you need to go there fast because they decline rapidly.
So anything interesting has been found? What happens?
This is not my field of work, gamma ray burst, but yes, absolutely, there are. There is a whole cottage cheese industry of for gamma ray burst that is still very very alive now. So we know that they have superluminal jets, right? That the gamma rays are shot out at Lorentz factors near 100, and they impact, they slam into the material around the jet, and they hit it. And this material re-emits radiation thermally at other wavelengths. If you're interested, I can dig up some review papers and I can point you to those.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Hey, Guy, did you have some questions?
I guess so. I had some years ago, when I was still a classroom teacher, I got a chance to work at the Naval Research Lab for a couple of summers, working with students and also doing some research and making stuff. And I happened to one summer work with the germanium strip detectors that were detecting X-rays, and they were very, very coarse resolution. The strips were like 5 millimeters apart, which is nothing compared to obviously silicon detectors, which you measure in microns. I wasn't aware that SWIFT had that sort of a detector. It had some advantages, but also had some disadvantages.
Yeah, so SWIFT is getting old, by the way. So it's that technology may be obsolete right now. It's been up for over 10 years. It's time that we think about a successor. It cannot last forever.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Yeah, I'm wondering, can these gamma ray bursts damage the Earth if they get too close? I don't have a sense of how powerful they are.
They're very powerful. So the energy emitted is of the order of 10 to the 50 ergs per second. So they are more powerful than any other object in the universe. And the best part is that all this energy is emitted in very few seconds. So the impact is tremendous. Yes, if a gamma ray burst exploded in our galaxy, we would be toast, probably.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So far, so good. You need to have a certain type of progenitor, right, to get at least the long gamma ray burst. so far we have been lucky. We are in a good place of the galaxy, but anything can happen.
I mean, couldn't a progenitor be the big black hole that's in the middle of the Milky Way galaxy?
This is probably something, the black hole would probably do something else. But the progenitors of the long gamma ray burst are supernovae, right? And a certain kind of supernova. And now the progenitor of short gamma ray burst, one progenitor is these two neutron star colliding. So this is probably, I don't know the probability of this happening, but there are many neutron stars in space. So it could happen.
Just to follow up one more thing, I thought the star Betelgeuse was supposed to become a supernova in the not too distant future, maybe not our lifetimes, but.
It could be, yes. Betelgeuse has been in the news recently, right? Because of the bright variations. Some people have thought about aliens communicating from Betelgeuse, and it turns out that it's a physical phenomenon. Do you remember, Joe, what the physical? Yeah, production of dust that has varied the luminosity of the star.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right, any other questions?
There is one.
Are we making any progress in determining the Hubble constant with this new measurement?
Excellent questions. Question, yes. So we have only one object so far, right, for which we have the counterpart in electromagnetic and for which we can measure the redshift. And this has been this kilonova that I talked about. So the gravitational waves have provided an estimate of the distance from modeling of the gravitational waves. And the redshift, as you know, is connected to the Hubble constant. So the two things together give you a measure of the Hubble constant, and I think it came out very close to 13.4 billion years. But you're also aware probably that there is a discrepancy between the measurements through the spectrometric redshift and the and other measurements. So we are, I don't know what the progress, if progress has been made, but it's very scary. It's one of the most fundamental, it's the fundamental constant of cosmology. And so if things don't agree, there must be something really a fault in our physics, in our understanding of some processes.
As I understand it, the two other methods, they do not overlap in their margins of error. Where does this new measurement show up between the other two?
It overlaps with one of them.
Overlaps with one of them. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay, any other questions?
Just a comment. There's clearly a whole lot that we don't know. We can only detect something like 4% of the universe, maybe. And the, you know, the dark matter, we have still no idea what it is. We can rule out a number of things. And then the dark energy, we don't really know what that is. And the neutrino detection devices have a pretty low record of sensitivity, I should say. Not not detecting them very, very often. And of course, there's zillions of them going through our bodies apparently every instant. And so there's a whole lot we just simply don't know.
That's right. We already don't know everything in electromagnetics, looking with the electromagnetic spectrum. Now imagine the forest, what the forest will look like when we add the sound provided by the known electromagnetic messengers. It's going to be a whole world of discoveries. So really exciting times ahead. Advanced LIGO, the ground-based detector for gravitational waves, is coming on board next year. LISA is going to detect gravitational waves at lower frequency in space. It's going to be launched in the 2030s. Neutrinos, next generation detectors are also coming online. It's going to be an explosion of discoveries.
Right. Well, thank you very much for this enlightening talk. And
thank you all for inviting me.
Yeah. Let's...
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank two of the people present. Guy Brandenburg made what I think is a very creative suggestion in the Stardust, that we use the Halloween trick-or-treaters and their parents. We take that opportunity to show them objects in the sky by those members of our organization who have telescopes at home on Halloween. The other person I'd like to particularly thank is Todd, who really does a stupendous job in creating the Stardust newsletter. It always has news items that I hadn't known about, but that which are intensely interesting. So thanks to both of you.
And before we leave, I'd like to, exploring the sky, I'd like to point out that it has been also on Meetup, and some of the people, we did have about 15, 17 people at one of the sessions, and I'm going to try and make sure that it's mentioned on Meetup next year. So that'll also help to bring in people at our observing sessions.
And I've also put out on the listserv, there's some other things that you can participate in that are further out, like the Hopewell Observatory, but also things that are attended by a lot of people. For example, the Sky Meadows, they have an observing session there that you can join if you'd like, if you want to sign up and become certified to bring your own telescope there. And that's quite a bit darker than Rock Creek Park, which is
yes.
Everything gets a little worse every year, though.
Before we end the meeting, I want to reach out to some of the new members or new names that I'm seeing on the Zoom call. I want to check in to see if you got, if you have joined up, paid your dues, and if you got the newsletter or some of the recent meeting updates. If you have not, please reach out to us and let us know so that we can make sure that you're on the newsletter list and on the club discussion list. Okay, so we'd love to meet you and talk to you. So feel free to, you know, show your video. We can say hi if you have questions for any of the officers. Now's a good time to kind of really quickly ask us. You can also reach out on email. Any final questions or discussions? Guy, I'll let you end the meeting.
Yeah, okay. Actually, I've got the email list. I could maybe put a note on there about the other list.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, I think I will end this meeting. Thank you all very much for coming. Our speaker has left, and yep. Hope this is exciting. Hope to see.
Very good. Very good talk.
Yes.
Yeah.
Don't forget to go out and do something a little bit original for Halloween and October 15th. If you would like to come out to visit Hopewell Observatory, we will be here. Okay. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone. Good
night.
Good
night.
Good
night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Hey, Todd, how are you doing? I kind of only just really on Thursday, I think, finally read your message about being sick. You doing better now?
Oh, yeah. I was over it about a week ago.
All right, that's good to hear.
Yeah, it was, except for getting food poisoning the first day or so, it wasn't too bad.
Okay.
I was able to get the newsletter done.
Yep, no, I kind of was traveling and got back and then pretty much got overwhelmed with some stuff at work and everything. So that's always a tough thing.
Yeah. If you could send me a copy of the
final draft. Did I send it back to you yet? Okay, I thought I was getting all that. Okay, I'll send it back to you.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks. I can get started on it then.
Sure. Okay, gotcha.
Hey, Jeff.
All right, then I'll talk to y'all later. Have a good evening.
Talk to you later.
All right. Bye.